there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us.
If you're just tuning in, we have started a new book, Ray Bradbury's Zen in the Art of Writing. If you'd like to participate in some of these activities or read the show notes, go over to Patreon. We'll give you more information at the end of the podcast, so tune in.
Welcome to Words to Write By.
Welcome to Words to Write By. How you doing, Kim?
Not too bad.
What words have you written this week?
I have been surprisingly productive, but not in that way that actually gets anything done. I know I'm doing a lot of writing, but I don't have much to show for it. However, I have been doing a lot of writing. I worked on an article. I've been working on a couple of short stories. I've found a really good spot to get an hour's worth of writing done.
Really?
Yes.
Where? Oh, wait. Maybe you don't want to tell us.
No, I can tell you. My son is taking a jiu-jitsu course.
Oh.
And it's only an hour long, so there's no place for me to go but to sit there in the gym while he does his jiu-jitsu. So I've been bringing a set of headphones and a journal to write in. And I've just been writing.
Excellent. That's a great idea. And this is once a week?
Twice a week.
Ooh.
And Renee, what words have you written this week?
Well, like you, I wrote an article spurred on by you because you wrote an article and I went, oh, I should do that too. So that inspired me to write an article about figuring out where my time was going. I don't seem to get enough writing done, but why? So I do a reverse calendar. So if you want to hear more about that, you'll have to go to our website.
You know the best thing about writing for your own blog or your own website? You don't have to worry about an editor rejecting you.
That's true. Another good thing is having a blog and a website with another writer friend. They will help you edit it before it goes live. You won't say anything dumb.
There you go. Okay.
Today we muse about the muse, and Bradbury tells us his method of feeding and caring for his. Then we move on to Mr. Electrico and Bradbury's journey to becoming a writer, which sparks a conversation about our own journeys, when we realized we could write, when we decided to call ourselves writers.
So, Kim, what do you think of chapters 3 and 4 of Ray Bradbury's Zen in the Art of Writing?
It's really enjoyable. However, I will note that because he is such a lyrical writer, that it's easy to scan through, and I had to stop myself and go back with my underliner and really try to parse each sentence. There's a lot of stuff in there, but it's not bullet pointed. It's not check, check, check. It's like you kind of have to dig for some of the stuff.
Yeah, he's not lecturing you.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't like a class.
No, this is like you're at a conference and you overhear a really interesting conversation.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost like his ode to his writing life. You know, I think it's great that we're reading these books the way we are, because I would also not have read it so closely, and I would have missed so many beautiful gems from it. And it is extremely inspiring.
I want to be the kind of writer that Ray Bradbury was. He found what he wanted to do in life, and he continued to do it in life, and it brought him such joy, as well as actually, you know, making a career of it.
Yeah, I would love to be a writer like Ray Bradbury. He is not the tortured writing soul. This guy was excited to get up, well, supposedly, in his writing. He says that he was excited to get up every day. And that electric energy, for me, I like it. It wakes up the writer.
Chapter 3 starts with the idea of a muse, or muse. Is it muse or muse?
I think it's muse. That's how we pronounce it. Yeah.
Starts with the idea of a muse. Ray Bradbury has a couple examples, which I will say I don't actually particularly care for. I think the first one is meant to be the idealized version that a lot of people consider a muse, as this shy female fairy that will run at the slightest bit of attention.
Yeah. When he references the muse, it's clear to me I see the Greek god in the heavens, you know, on Mount Olympus, and you're trying to coax her down.
Right. And I don't think that's how he saw the muse. I think that's just the example that he gave that people see. The frustration a lot of people have, I can't come up with the ideas. I think the muse is two different things. Some people see it as the inspiration, the spark of ideas, and some people see it as the ability to sit down and write out those ideas.
It's kind of both. And for Bradbury, he used the muse and the subconscious interchangeably. And for a guy who likes a lot of metaphors, he didn't really use a lot for the muse.
He compared it to spots on the eye, which I didn't think really worked out that well.
Oh, yeah, the flecks, he said there were like the little spots on your eye. Yeah, that was weird. I didn't quite understand that. He did include a poem, though, by Oscar Wilde.
Do you want to read it?
Sure. There's this Oscar Wilde poem, but you're supposed to substitute the word art for love. He included this stanza. Art will fly if held too lightly. Art will die if held too tightly. Lightly, tightly, how do I know whether I'm holding or letting art go? How sweet. Most of the writing books say to show up every day, and the muse shows up whenever it darn well feels like it, but at least you're available when that muse appears, which seems to be the most practical advice.
How do you see your muse?
So I was thinking about this, and I decided it was a stray cat.
Oh no, I chose a cat too.
Of course, we're cat ladies. I specifically said it's not a house cat, it is a stray cat. It's a stray cat because you kind of fall in love with it. You feel like it's yours, even though it's nobody's. They're their own cat. And you feed it, and you feel like it's chosen you. But then if you show up one day and you try to feed it and it's not there, you take it personally. But, you know, they probably have like a whole neighborhood. They're visiting all sorts of people. It's that kind of cat that you have to coax to get them to come to you. They have to slowly get used to you. You feed it every day, but it never becomes a house cat. It's its own cat. It likes being an alley cat.
So likes its freedom.
It likes its freedom. You try to keep it, and it just doesn't want to be kept, but it does love you in its own way.
Okay, so my muse is like one of my house cats. Mm. And specifically, it's the cat when I'm sitting down and suddenly it comes over and sits on my lap and just kind of plops down, and you can tell it wants a petting. So you start petting, and it starts purring, and it rolls over for more. You keep petting, and then the hair starts coming over everywhere, and you're stuck there with this cat. You made the decision to start petting, and now, like, you feel bad when you step away.
Yeah.
Honestly, I can get started. If I pick the right portion of the day, I'm in the right mindset, it just all starts coming. But it's a conscious choice whether I'm going to start petting this cat, or whether I just pay attention to something else or open up my phone. You know, the cat's not going to punish me or anything like that. It might give me a little stink eye, but overall, like, it just sits there. But if I want to engage in it and I start petting, then I really need to keep petting.
Mm.
And good stuff comes.
I can see that. I can definitely see that.
And my main problem is I'm not as good at petting my cat all the time because I've got other stuff to do. But if I could always pet the cat whenever it showed up, things would be good.
I like that. I'm going to think about that next time I've got the muse and be like, I'm focusing just on the cat.
Just going to make it happy.
Just going to make it happy. Yeah. Your cat, Pinto. That would be a wonderful muse. He's very hard to ignore because he's so darn cute. I love your cat, Pinto.
So Bradbury's next idea is how to feed the muse. And he's got a specific regimen or specific routine.
I love this metaphor. He says that you have to feed the muse and you have to create a menu for the muse. And I'm like, oh my God, that makes so much sense. You have to pick from a variety of different places to get your inspiration and to feed it. His first one is poetry. He's a big lover of poetry. He says that if poetry's on your menu, it helps you with the senses, sensory details. And even if you don't understand poetry, your brain does. You just don't realize it.
I liked his comment. Let's say that each of us has fed himself on life first and later on books and magazines. The difference is that one set of events happened to us and the other was forced feeding.
Yeah. It's like that difference between experience and then books. Mm-hmm.
So that was the poetry.
Yes, poetry. It was wonderful. And then the other one was essays. What do you think of when you think of essays when you were reading this?
Well, obviously I think of something assigned to me in a class. Mm. But an essay is just a carefully constructed piece of nonfiction. could be creative nonfiction. It could be a report of something. The idea is to expose yourself to curated thoughts of somebody else on something that's real. A lot of my news reading actually is just more like you're reading the same article again and again, printed in other places, trying to get more information. But I think here it's more like you want to sit down and just consume, to really turn on the parts of your brain that are set for learning.
Yeah. And you don't know if it's useful or not. You just got to trust the process. Mm-hmm. And again, he keeps bringing up the subconscious is like these things you don't know are going to be useful later. How do you know your brain isn't chewing on something from 5 years ago on an article you read about dinosaurs?
Right.
Then later comes in to inform a story that you're writing now.
And finally, he recommends reading a short story a day.
That's a tall order. But I guess flash fiction would be easy.
You could modulate it. You could go between a short story, like 2,000 words would be pretty easy. But like 5,000 or 6,000 words every day would be kind of hard.
Yeah, I guess I could do it. It just seems like it would be daunting trying to keep up with that amount. But maybe not. I mean, I know Stephen King is an insanely heavy reader. He's constantly reading.
You know, you just have to look at what you're spending your time on and maybe a little less time with my game app and more time doing reading.
Yes, less time baking cakes and more time reading. He talks about pulp culture as part of feeding your muse.
I think this segues really well to what the difference between Bradbury's approach is and Gardner's approach. Gardner wasn't necessarily against pulp culture, but he believed in a curated list. He said, you need to read all these classics in an organized fashion that someone else has come up with. And Bradbury's like, read everything.
Yeah. Gardner was the ultimate gatekeeper. It's like, you want a curated list from a specific person. Only certain people are allowed to curate that list. And it just so happened to be academia. For Bradbury, it was like, no. He says, I am many things that America has been in my time. I had enough sense to keep moving, learning, growing, and I have never reviled or turned my back on the things I grew out of. I learned from Tom Swift, and I learned from George Orwell, and my muse has grown out of the mulch of good, bad, and indifferent. Whereas Gardner calls stuff like literary stunts and trash and, you know.
Right. The other thing is that Gardner's premise is, even if you go as far as back as Plato or Shakespeare or whatever, that they were the masters and they understood these stories and this is where you're going to learn how to write. It doesn't matter what your own personal experiences are. It doesn't matter what the world that you're living in is. You're going to reach back to these masters for techniques and approaches and ways of thinking. And Bradbury's all about the subconscious. It's like, you know, just feed it in and it's going to come out. And it's these experiences, these things that you read, it's all going to get jumbled in. And your brain's going to process these things and it's going to come out. It's not conscious. It's the subconscious.
I feel like Bradbury's muse reminds me a lot of Neil Gaiman's Gods and American Gods, where the more you believe, the more power that God has.
And the other part I found was his criteria. The constants remain, the search, the finding, the admiration, the love, the honest response to material at hand, no matter how shabby they one day seem. The idea is, if you loved that particular book as a child, and you go back and go, oh my God, the guy was so sexist. It's okay to have loved something in the past and not to love it now, because you're going to reach back to that moment when you loved it.
You're going to get back in tune with the love itself, what it was that was that emotion and that connection that you had.
The majority of Gardner's materials probably would not be useful because you don't love them. It's a tedious thing you've got to read. And maybe you learn to appreciate it over time as you train yourself, but that's like like if you decide that you're going to go on a non-sugar diet, at a certain point, fruit's going to be the best sugar ever because you're not allowed to touch any of the other stuff.
That's true.
Okay. So I think we've done our dig at Gardner for the podcast. We're still going strong, even though we're no longer reading his book.
Yeah.
Let's move on to chapter 4.
Chapter 4. These are short chapters, dear listener, but I think both me and Kim really encourage you to not read these quickly. It's very easy to read them quickly. If you want to really get something out of it, you've got to read these maybe twice. Take notes, because then you're going to notice his language more. You're going to enjoy this meal that is Ray Bradbury.
So chapter 4 is a bit more personal. I mean, all the chapters are fairly personal. This one, he examines what made him a writer, what events in his life shaped him as a writer. And he references a whole bunch of books that he wrote or stories that came out of these experiences. What were your favorite parts of Bradbury's journey to becoming a writer?
Well, some of them echoed mine, so I almost felt like, oh, good, I guess I was on some right path. I really liked that he found an adult that was not an adult. He found somebody named Mr. Electronico. He was part of a carnival, and I guess Bradbury went to this carnival and bought this little magic trick from him, and it didn't work, so he went back. I could just see this stern little boy going up to Mr. Electro saying, hey, I bought this from you, sir. It doesn't work. And so he said, oh, and he fixes it. But then he took him on a tour of the carnival and just went around, going around having to meet the illustrated people and the bearded women and all of these people. He just took him by the hand and just respected this little boy, looked him in the eye and had actual conversations with him.
And this guy was like, none of the grown-ups around you. And this is the guy that did say magic was real. When you come to that conclusion that Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy aren't real, you're basically thrust into a world where there isn't magic, where it's all logical. That's what all the grown-ups are telling you, and you've left that all behind. And here, Bradbury has come in contact with someone that says, no, I knew you in your past life.
Yeah.
You will live forever. Bradbury didn't actually say this, but what it was, he could believe in magic again. The normal grown-up world where someone goes to college and gets a job and gets married and has kids and retires and all those mundane things that happen to adults. And here was another choice.
Yeah, yeah. He was Bradbury's catalyst.
So the part I liked was he talks about how he wrote every day.
Can we read that quote? I was actually so inspired by it that I wrote it down on a note card and I put it on my whiteboard.
Go for it.
But how did I begin? Starting in Mr. Electrico's year, I wrote 1,000 words a day. For 10 years, I wrote at least one short story a week, somehow guessing that a day would finally come when I truly got out of the way and let it happen. And that really spoke to me because I don't get out of my own way. I read all these damn craft books and I just don't sit down and write enough. What do you think, Kim? Do you think this is hubris? Is anyone realistically going to write 1,000 words a day?
Yeah, I think people do write 1,000 words a day. I think people do prioritize their writing and they give up on other stuff and they just simply sit down and write. The question is whether they write 1,000 worthwhile words a day. I've sometimes run into the issue where I'm going to write 3 pages a day and after a while I'm like, there's not much in here.
Well, he says he wrote short stories. So I guess his 1,000 words a day was writing short stories, specifically like focused writing. I don't think they were free writes.
Mm-hmm. So he talked about the transition where he went, where he wrote a whole bunch up in the attic. And the quotes are, it took me many years to write myself down out of the attic. This was the place where he was isolated and all the stories came from his head. And then he talks about taking my childhood luggage, my uncles, aunts, my mom, dad, my brother with me. The transition is he went from having all these ideas in his own head to experiencing the people around him and incorporating them into his stories.
So he's mixing what he knows with what he doesn't know, really.
Right. He's grabbing from outside him as well.
Mm-hmm.
And other people. It's not just experiences he has, but like looking at other people, listening to other people. In Gardner's book, he explicitly said, nobody wants to hear about your Aunt Ethel. Don't just go writing about the people around you. And Bradbury says, no, those are your people. Bradbury says, the people that are around you, make it into your stories. So that was another way he's different than Gardner.
To me, that makes it feel like they're going to be more real. Those people are going to be more real because they were real people that he's basing them off of.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard that advice before, where you can base his character on a mixture of different people.
Right. And so to give Gardner credit, Bradbury is not saying, write about your Aunt Ethel in her house in the Midwest doing her baking.
Right.
He says, put her on Mars and have these other things happen to her.
Put the sensibilities of Aunt Ethel on Mars and how would it play out? In a spaceman.
Reading all about Bradbury's journey, I was struck by, on the one hand, you're reading about the successful writer that did these incredible things that happened back in the day when a newlywed apartment could go for $30 a month.
God, we've come a long way from that.
You're reading this and saying, well, this is really great for him. I'm glad it worked out. We're in a completely different time period mm-hmm. and all these things are different. But still, reading about his journey makes you think about your own. I had 2 questions that came up with, I want Renee and then I'll answer as well. When did you first consider becoming a writer professionally? And when did you know that you could write?
Those are 2 very different questions.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to do what my husband does all the time. Well, when did you? Then what was your journey, Kim?
For me, I remember specifically in the 4th grade, having to write some creative stories. And I had a fairly small class, and I realized that, like, I could put the other girls in my class and in the stories. I wrote this down, and for once, instead of being hard, like in third grade, you know, writing is hard, just getting words and sentences out, suddenly it became easy. And not only that, but then I would read what I had written to these girls, and they liked it. That was the jump, where suddenly I knew I could write.
When did you want to be a writer?
I think at that point, it occurred to me to be a writer, but I also wanted to be a scientist. So went back and forth. And mostly it became scientist for a very long time. But in fourth grade is when I recognized that all those kind of daydream stuff in my head could actually come out on paper and could be communicated to other people and they would enjoy it.
Hmm.
I actually decided to become a writer when I was 37,
38. 37, 38, wow.
And decided to apply for a writing program and become a writer.
That was a long jump from, what, fourth grade to your late 30s.
Yeah, I did all sorts of writing in between. I mean, I did NaNoWriMo, but I was always something kind of on top of everything else.
So. Just like a hobby.
Yeah.
Now you're a writer. I would say you're a writer.
I think I'm a writer because I don't have anything else.
Well, we do have articles that you've written.
That's a writer too. I'm saying I don't have any other profession right now. Yeah.
Well, that's not true. You are a podcaster.
There's that. Yes, I am a podcaster.
We're not getting paid, dear listener. Please go to Patreon.
And now that I've given you time.
Well, it is difficult to say. It was kind of a slow process. I was listening to Lorena McKennitt. I had her tapes and her CDs. It was in the 90s, dear listener. Oh my, the 90s. I was super into Irish mythology and mythology in general. And I just fell in love. I listened and listened. And I read her little book back in the day when we had CDs. We would read the little books that came with them. And she included all of the lyrics. And later I discovered that some of them were poems from Blake or Keats or Wordsworth. It just blew my mind. I'm like, this is poetry. Oh my gosh. And so I fell in love with romantic poetry. I thought it was so beautiful. And it made me feel smart because I went along my life not feeling like I was very smart. Being into things that I realized were poems. Real poems, old poems that I liked and thought I understood. It was a good boost. So I listened to a lot of that. And so I would say that she was a direct influence on me becoming a writer. Then I started scribbling in a notebook. I started writing my own poetry. When I decided to become a writer, I think, was about a couple of years later when I was about 18, 19 years old. I was exposed to Henry Miller, which, again, another writer you look back on going, oh my, the misogyny is everywhere. But man, he was very inspiring. He was part of that bohemian culture. And you don't need money. You can be homeless and just be a bum. I was working minimum wage and paying rent for couch space. So to me, I was like, I can access this life. I couldn't access making more than $4.25 an hour. Yes, I'm old. I couldn't access a lot of things that required a degree. But man, Henry Miller found a way to access these things. Bukowski found a way to access writing. And so since I was already interested in it, I had decided, well, that is what I will become, a writer. And I just invested so much time writing in my journals. You know, if I wasn't working at a deli or Baskin Robbins or a coat factory or all the jobs I had, I was on a bus listening to poetry, reading poetry or writing poetry and writing in a journal. And it was just lots and lots of writing. I must have definitely been writing 1,000 words a day back then. And it was all big fantasy in my head. And then eventually, sometime in college, I went, I wonder if I really could be a writer. I don't even know if I'm good enough. Maybe I could be.
The problem is that as a grown-up, you basically say, well, can I make money off of this? Can I support myself with my writing? And that's not a very easy road. So in a way, I think what's more important is when you decide that this will be your identity. I think that's the critical thing. When you were 18, even though you were working these poorly paid jobs, and in many ways your life was nothing exciting, nothing you'd see on TV, but you decide your identity would be that as a writer.
Well, I would say that my life was unfortunately exciting in unfortunate ways.
So when did you know you could write?
I just applied for the creative writing major at UCSC and they accepted me. And I went, oh, other people like my stuff.
When you were scribbling down all in your notebooks and stuff like that, did you have any idea that this was something special you could do that other people couldn't do?
I think I was just holding on to it for dear life as something that I was good at, and that I had just decided that I was good at it no matter what anybody said. It was more of an act of defiance where I'm going to do this no matter what. I really like how Bradbury says, from these primitive bricks, I love that, from these primitive bricks, I've built a life and a career by my staying in love with all of these amazing things, all of the good things in my existence have come about. You know, I haven't listened to Lorena McKenna in a long time, but I should just fire that up when I go drive over the hill when I go back home. Anyway, so what are we on now?
So I think it's time to talk about exercises. What are we going to do this week? I like the idea of the menu, where he commits to reading a poem, an essay, and a short story, and writes down what those are. I'm looking at my bookshelf, and I think that I could pull off for 1 week a poem, an essay, and a short story.
Every day?
Every day, and I'll write down what those things are so I can look back at them.
Okay, so it's like one of those fancy restaurants where every day the menu changes.
Yes.
Okay. Do we need to write anything or just do it and talk about our experience?
You know, we're feeding the subconscious here.
Right.
We're not actively committing to doing this or doing that. I would say if I'm reading a poem and I like a line, I'll write down the line. If I'm reading an essay and I learn some interesting fact, I might reference the fact. If I'm reading a short story, I might at least note whether I liked it or not.
Hmm.
But nothing more than a line or two. The trick of it is to actually do the reading and let the subconscious work.
Okay. And by the poem one, do you mean a poem or do you mean poetry, like the whole book?
Oh, a poem.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And as you're planning this out, you know, it's a menu. It's not every dish is in the same size. So you might go for something that's only three stanzas long for your poetry because you're going to be reading a big article or some flash fiction at the end of the day because you haven't got around to that short story.
That's true. That's true. Oh, this will be fun. Well, so we'll post our menu.
Yes.
On the website.
Yes. Or we'll post our menus in the Patreon account.
We will post our menus on the Patreon account.
Yeah.
And now, the activity.
And we're back after a week of reading. How did it go, Renee?
It went really well, actually. How about you?
I think it went pretty well. Did you find that you're reading a whole lot more than you usually read?
Definitely. It really highlighted how much I'm not reading. That was a big reveal. How about you?
I think I was reading a bit more, but I was reading more focused.
Mm.
As opposed to just randomly picking something up and reading it. Like I was like, okay, where am I going to find my poetry today? Okay, what piece of nonfiction? Is this article I'm reading? Does that count as my nonfiction? Is this serious enough for my nonfiction essay? Or no, maybe I better find something else. I think it focused me, made me a more...
Intentional?
Intentional. Reader? Yeah.
The poetry was pretty easy for me because I have tons of these books. I just haven't cracked them open in a while.
Because you were a trained poet, so you have a lot of poetry books.
A lot of them were books assigned to me in graduate school. I had quite a collection of my own. I've actually had to pare down the collection over the years because I don't live in a big space. And also, I had to ask the big questions like, am I really going to reread this book? Did I really like this poetry? So I went through some of the greatest hits ones, and I decided, okay, well, I'm allowed to read something that I've read before as long as I haven't read it in a decade. Two of them are two poets that I really enjoyed, and one was Joshua Beckman, and the other is Zachary Schoenberg. They're kind of lumped together. They may actually be friends, I'm not sure, but I was a big fan of them many years ago, and so I decided to reread them. But I put a little rule in place. I decided to only read one poem a day. So I was very tempted to just start reading the whole book. And I decided that I would just read one poem because after a while they just start to blur together. I was, like we said earlier, trying to be intentional with the practice.
So any one poem that you want to pitch or say what you got out of it?
Sure. One wonderful thing that came out of this was I decided to just write a line from each of the things I read that I thought was worthwhile. Even if I didn't think anything was worthwhile, I found a line. And sometimes that was work. But now I have this wonderful little book of lines. Let me find the one that I wrote recently. One from Joshua Beckman. Here's a line from his book, Take It. You have done all this, and now the frozen hair atop my head. You're mocking cosmic light through cloud. And no bird all day. Just really like that line. Do I got another one somewhere? The electric sand dollar is broken, lies drowned in mid-orange. And that was by a poet named Alex Green. You know, there's some really good lines in here. It's short, it's nice, it's like
orange juice from concentrate and you're just eating the concentrate. I really enjoyed getting back into reading poetry with so much intention. How did you find your poems?
So I had a collection of poetry too. There was 2 years where I subscribed to Poetry Magazine and I stopped the subscription when I realized that I wasn't even cracking the books when they came, and I obviously had enough poetry if I needed to look at it. So I was randomly picking out some, and for the most part, they were good, but it felt a little bit too random. Like, if you were going through the radio stations and you just clicked on something and you weren't sure what it was at all, and it's music just blared at you and you just weren't ready for it, and it just wouldn't be as enjoyable, as opposed to, like, I really want to hear some punk rock. Let me ask my iTunes and find what I want. So we perhaps become too accustomed to our curated devices. But one time I decided I'd actually look through the books and see if something jumped out that I wanted to read. And I haven't actually read too much of my poetry, but I did find a book that I picked up many years ago and I've been wanting to read all the way through. It was by a poet, Ilya Kaminsky. Have you ever heard of him?
No.
I've heard of him. He's deaf. Mm. So when he reads, he gives you a copy of his pieces too, because sometimes he doesn't enunciate enough. He's very emotional. He wrote this book called Death Republic, which is actually a story of a town where occupying forces kill a child, a death child, and the entire town in revolt becomes deaf. It doesn't go well. It's an unhappy story. So I read the whole thing as both one my fiction and my poetry for one time. It has someone say, "The deaf don't believe in silence. Silence is the invention of the hearing." The other line I really loved from it was, "We lived happily during the war, and when they bombed other people's houses, we protested, but not enough." So I think politically, that was where my mind was. I kind of wanted just to get that emotional response. So while I love the language of poetry, I'm also there for the way it pings certain emotions inside me.
It's lovely. We keep doing this. I might have to borrow that book.
I think I might lend you that book. Okay, so how about the nonfiction?
I kind of cheated. They aren't traditional essays in the sense that I went online and went to the New Yorker or something. I picked something up from your bookshelf, actually, that I had been seeing that I kind of wanted to try. And you also had mentioned in one of our episodes that a teacher had recommended this book. It's called The Courage to Write by Ralph Keyes. And normally I wouldn't pick up a book like that because it just seems a little too woo-woo. But given you said that it was good, or at least your professor said it was good, I thought, okay, I should read this. I have lots of negative self-talk.
I have to know, is it good?
So far, it's mentioned some things that have really touched on stuff that made sense. It's a good approach. Right now, it just feels very self-identifying. It's like, yes, I get the issue I'm having. He says, "The writing that shows up on paper is rarely as good as the writing in one's head. Anthony Burgess thought every book was a failure from the moment its first sentence was written, because this sentence destroyed forever the dream of what that book might be." And I thought, oh, okay, I feel better now. I feel better. It's not just me. He got this quote in there by Tom Wolfe. So now I want to read some more Tom Wolfe. I haven't read him in a while. And Tom Wolfe said, "The awful thing about the first sentence of any book is that as soon as you've written it, you realize this piece of work is not going to be the great thing you envisioned. It can't be." I was like, wow, okay, cool. And it's these big writers. You know, it makes me feel better.
So did you read a bit of that each day for your nonfiction?
I read a chapter. That would be considered my nonfiction for the day, is reading a chapter. I read, I think, 3 chapters of this. But then I switched over and I thought, well, I would like something more useful in my head. You know, and since I write memoir, I decided to read some Joanne Beard. And those are considered essays. They're just creative, personal nonfiction essays. And man, I think she's my new favorite memoirist. I love, love, love her. I mean, I think everybody loves her because all the teachers assigned The Fourth State of Being. Like, this is one of her big signature essays that came out of her greatest hit, kind of her single that comes out of The Boys of My Youth. But her children's voice, like the voice from her point of view as a child, is so perfect. Her perspective is so clean. I'm just in love. How about you? What did you pick?
I actually went far and wide on my nonfiction.
Cool.
I do like reading a lot of articles. So I tried to focus on certain feature writing
that were longer pieces that if I could find a print version, that was my goal. So if I could find a print version of the nonfiction so I could underline and kind of consume it in a informed way as opposed to something just to give me a distraction. I did try one of C.S. Lewis's essays on stories because I had the book on the shelf and it looked very nice. And I could barely make it through. Oh, my God. I was tired, and I've gotten to the age where my eyes don't always focus on the page very well. And, oh, I mean, I was determined. It was late at night. I didn't want to try something different at that point. I just need to get read. And I got through it, and I couldn't tell you a single thing that was in it. However, I did have some success. We subscribed to The Atlantic, and I almost never read the paper print version because I read them online when they come out. But there was a really long piece about the current state of Saudi Arabia. I had purposely not read it online because it was so incredibly long. But I sat down, I read it, and I think this falls in the category of Bradbury saying that just gives you ideas of places and things, because this describes what's going on in Saudi Arabia right now, and it is crazy, some of the changes and things. Up until very recently, women couldn't drive cars there.
Right.
And now they can.
Yes.
Up until recently, restaurants had to be divided, and single men had to eat in a separate area than families and single women.
Wow.
Now they can. Now women can go to movie theaters and sit next to a male they don't know and watch the movie.
Oh, wow.
So things are really changing there. And there's a bunch of bad stuff. I mean, it's not consistent. Some people have accused this article of being overly pro-Saudi Arabia, and I don't think that it is. But they talk about various things, and one of them is they're building a city, a new city, in the middle of the desert. The city will be built along a line. The centerpiece of the project will be the line, a 106-mile-long, very skinny urban strip connected by a single bullet train that will travel from end to end in 20 minutes. Parentheses. No train capable of this speed currently exists. He's designing the city that's going to be in the middle of nowhere. And so far, Neiman is less of a city than an urbanist cargo cult. Anyway, but this concept of the city with just a single train that goes through and everything being, let me explain. The line is intended to be walkable. The train will run underground, and a short hike perpendicular to its main axis will take you into pristine desert. Water will be desalinated, energy renewable. So like the single town is a single line where you can get to everywhere by this train, and then you jump out and like there's only a block further of houses and such, and then you're out in the desert.
Wow.
I just think that this is like kind of one of those science fiction concepts I could see getting in my brain and then years later saying, oh, I'm going to have this city with just a single line.
Yeah.
So I think this kind of falls into what Bray Bradbury was saying, that he got ideas that he later incorporated. Found several articles like this and found them to really meet to have in my brain. And then I have on my list if I ever go back and look at them.
Nice.
Okay, how about fiction?
Fiction time. So I had two books and I thought, how is this going to be the most useful for me in the project that I'm working on? I had these two books sitting there for a while, and one of them was a book that a teacher of mine was pulling from, and so I went and bought the book. It's called The Story Behind the Story. There's the story, and then after that is the author writing a short essay about how they wrote it or what they were inspired by. The other book is another anthology called Coming of Age, and I bought that early on when I was talking to an editor of mine, and she's like, your theme is coming of age. I said, oh, that's good to know, and this is a while ago. And so I bought a book of short stories because I wanted to see all of the themes and how they've been tackled with coming of age. I bought it and I read a couple of short stories and I never got further. But now I need to draw from a well. And so I had these handy short stories. They're great. Great, great, great. I enjoy dipping in to a short story. They don't take long to read. They're intense, usually. I just go, why did I wait so long? There's a couple of lines. Let's see. One story I really liked was by Alberto Alvaro Rios, and it was called The Secret Lion. One line was, nature seemed to keep pushing us around one way or another, teaching us the same thing every place we ended up. Nature's gang was tough that way, teaching us stuff. Another line, which isn't like profound, but I liked the way that it was written. And it was short and concise, and it carried exactly the image that this author wanted. We thought with our eyes to each other.
In the end, you are a poet, aren't you?
What do you mean?
I mean, like, you're really attracted to just, like, a way something's phrased and the way the words come together. Because listening to that line, I would have no clue what the story was about.
Oh.
I mean, that's a line could almost be from a poem, right?
Sure, yeah. It was a very poetic line. So, yeah, I guess maybe that's why I was...
It's what you like, I
mean. That's what I like. Well, yeah, that's another thing. You learn what you like. You think we know what we like, but we really have to seek it out and go pick up books from the shelf and intentionally read. You really learn early on what you're really into, which I think is very important.
Yeah, I don't think I'll be picking up that C.S. Lewis one anytime soon again.
Yeah, that one sounds like a boring thing. You're never going to get that time back.
So I had some good luck, too. I've got a library book right now by Edward P. Jones that has a whole bunch of stories of people's lives in Washington, D.C. And the funny thing was that the first one I read, I didn't really care for. I was like, okay, whatever. And the second one got good. And the third one, I was like, this is really good. And I'm not quite sure if what I'm getting out of it is he just put a weaker story at the beginning and there's more, or if you read a short story about a person and you read another one, you kind of get their groove, or if it's actually something intentionally. This is meant to build on the previous one. I've read some books in the past where there were linked short stories. This one doesn't appear to be linked, but there's still kind of a feel like I'm getting to know the area, like I'm getting to know the lives of people in that area, and it's starting to make a bit more sense. I don't know. I also read from Bradbury's The Illustrated Man. I read the first story in that called The Veldt, and that's the one with the tigers and the lions that eat the horrible parents.
I love that story.
The thing about it is that, you know, they're living in a smart home.
Smart home, isn't it?
It is. The lights come on when they come upstairs and turn off afterwards. The kitchen cleans itself. I mean, they have this magical table where they just call it and out comes dinner, which seems pretty cool.
Yeah. It's like the thing in Star Trek. The replicator.
The thing that Ray Bradbury gets wrong, he was imagining that all this stuff would work. And if you actually try to make yourself a smart home, it's more complicated than you want it to be. It's just only things don't line up. But it was a brand new house that was built all the way. Anyway, so I read The Veldt. I think I will grab from some more Ray Bradbury short stories. So the next question is, are we going to keep doing this?
About 3 days in, I realized I wanted to do this forever. I really love it. You know what's great is it feels like me time. No matter what happens, I get these things. I get to read a chapter of some nonfiction piece. I get to read the story and I get to read a poem. And everyone has to wait. What about you? Are you going to keep this up?
Yeah, I think so. And I think we are going to stop here and finish our podcast, but there'll be a bonus podcast in which we go further about how we plan to continue going through some of the techniques we applied, some of the things we learned that we're not going to do again as to keep it going. And we'll save that for our bonus podcast, which will be for our Patreon listeners. You want to tell them about what Patreon listeners get, Renee?
All right. So you get this bonus episode if you subscribe to Abby, the fabulous level. It's only $2. And you get some really great bonus material. You'll get my chapter notes, which are very thorough.
Have you started the chapter notes yet for Ray Bradbury?
I have step one done. I have a very methodical way of doing it to make sure they're very thorough. I go through and I highlight all the and make comments in the margins of all the quotes I think are important. And then I retype those quotes out on a document and then I restate them and put them together. And it's a process, but have faith. I actually love doing it. It is really fun. So there's some very thorough notes on there. There's bonus episodes where me and Kim talk about the activities that we're doing and we workshop each other's stuff. And there's some very valuable conversations in there, so much so that I've re-listened to them because, you know, it's on my work, you know, so it's like, well, I want to remember the lesson I learned from this.
And the other part of our Patreon site is we really want to build up a community of people that want to improve their writing. So we're including questions that people can answer and see what other people have written and get feedback that way. So if you are interested, check it out. We've made the first bonus podcast from the start of the Ray Bradbury book free for people that want to listen to it. So you can listen to our review of our bonus podcast from the first two chapters. We also have a post that everyone can contribute to about their first experience reading Ray Bradbury or finding Ray Bradbury.
Yeah, it's called Chime In, and you can access it through our website, or you can just find us on Patreon, and anyone can access it. And yeah, man, just go on there and tell us what was your first Bradbury.
Yeah, the Patreon account is Words We Write by Podcast, so it's pretty easy to find.
Yeah.
And another way you guys can support us is you can subscribe to us on the podcast subscriber that you listen to. We've been noticed that there are some people subscribing because when we released the episode, there's almost 20 immediate downloads, so that's good. If you could leave a review on Apple Podcasts, that'd be really great. And one thing is, if you know somebody who's a writer that might enjoy this podcast, recommend us.
That goes a very long way. And it takes a lot of time to put these episodes together. It is a labor of love. It's very helpful, though, when we get some feedback and people listen. So, yeah, share.
Okay, well, thanks so much for coming, and we will see you in 2 weeks. Bye.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
Oh my God, we should get a meow. We should do a meow. And then we know we're switching from, I'm just, maybe not. Okay.
Maybe not.